Hi, listeners. Welcome to another episode of Worlds Collide, the podcast about moving abroad. I'm your host, Victoria. And first, I just wanted to say thank you for tuning in today. Okay, so before we start, I just wanted to mention that if you are a frequent listener on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, it would be super awesome from you if you give my podcast a 5-star rating, because that would help immensely to be better recognized. Also, don't forget to push the follow button in the corner of your app, and then you will always see when a new episode is coming out and you won't miss any. That is so great, isn't it? Okay, so enough of that. And I want to do a brief introduction of today's episode. So my guest is Linda, and she and her family, they lived abroad for 26 years. That's a long time. And she and her husband just moved back a year ago to the United States. And so we have an honest conversation about how it has been, the good and the bad, but mostly honest. So yeah, here's Linda. So my guest today is Linda. Hi, Linda. How are you?
Hello, Victoria. So nice to meet you.
Yeah, likewise. So where are you calling from?
Right now, I'm in Annapolis, Maryland, house sitting for my brother-in-law, who's from Germany.
Ah, okay. See? Nice. Nice coincidence. Yeah. But you just moved back to the United States, right? Not too long ago?
No, actually a year ago yesterday.
Oh, okay. Wow, that's an anniversary.
Yeah. It's somehow it's managed to be like, just the time has just dragged and also flown by at the same time. I don't know how, by physics, I don't know how that's even possible.
Yeah, it's like sometimes some days feel just like very long and then others just go by. Or like then the total was like, oh, that was just 6 months ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so where did you move back from?
I moved back from Japan. My husband and I had lived in Japan for altogether 26 years.
Wow, that's a long time. Mm. Okay, so let's start then in the beginning. What brought you to Japan?
Well, I moved away from the United States when I was in my 20s. And I traveled around a bit, and then I had quit university because I at that time hadn't known what I was doing. And then when I turned 30, I'm like, oh, I think I know what I want to do. So I went back to school, met my husband, but I didn't really want to continue living in the United States. Uh-huh. So I really wanted to go back to Europe. And we applied. My husband was a teacher, and so he applied for a job in France. Mm-hmm. And they were like, no, we do not want you.
Okay, this is how they said it. So, very cliche.
Yes, I know, but it was so true. They were so uninterested. In contrast, the Japanese government was like, will you come here? Will you come to us? And so we went there for 3 years. And my son was born there. And then my husband went back again to the United States. We came back to the United States for 4 years so he could get his PhD. And then we went back to Japan. So and then we lived there, you know, for 23 years.
Okay. In which city were you?
The first time we were in this little town called Hagi, which is, you know, Japan is three different main islands, and it was in the main island, but at the very southern point, and it was really isolated.
Okay.
The second time we went to Osaka, which is like the second largest city, the third largest city. And then we ultimately ended up in a place called Hadano, which is like a bedroom community for Tokyo. It's about an hour and 20 minutes away from Tokyo. And that was a really interesting mix of the two. Like, it was still country, but we were close to Tokyo, close to Yokohama, close to some beautiful like holiday resort areas.
Okay, can I ask you, so your husband, he was teaching there, and what about you? What did you do when you first were there for the 3 years?
Oh, when I was there for the first 3 years, I just took individual classes, you know, like uh-huh. when you're an English speaker. So this would have been in the early 90s. This was, yeah. You know, now there are just a ton of foreigners in Japan. But at that time, there weren't that many. Mm-hmm. And we, like I said, we were in this isolated little place. And so you could not go to Japan and not end up teaching English.
Okay. Uh-huh, yeah.
Please teach my child English.
Okay.
Teaching them as well. So that yeah. was what I mainly did. And then uh-huh. like I said, we decided to have our first child there. And so mm-hmm. then, you know, for the remaining time, I was a mom.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely, because it takes it's a lot of work.
It is.
Yeah. And how old was your child when you moved back to the United States?
18 months.
18 months. Okay, so it was almost like half time. He was there for like the half of the time.
Yes. Yeah. For uh-huh. half. Our first time there was 3 years, and yeah, so we came back after 18 months, and he was a cute little thing. Like, you know, I remember holding him at a grocery store, and you know, the Japanese, when they speak, they often nod their heads in agreement. Mm-hmm. There was my son, like,
okay.
What's wrong with him? He's Japanese.
Were you, though, nervous being pregnant in a foreign country at that time?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. It was so different. Because then when my husband came back for his PhD, that was when I had my daughter. And so I actually have the two experiences to compare. And sure, I was really nervous because, you know, our Japanese was terrible and the doctor's Japanese was great, but his English was, you know, I don't want to say pathetic. That would be the wrong word.
Okay.
We did get
but very little.
It was very little. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there were some people who I had a midwife and she didn't speak any English. I don't know. Like somehow we just managed.
Okay. Yeah.
In hindsight, I'm like, what was I thinking? But it worked.
How did you communicate? Like with hands and feet or?
Well, my son is almost 30 years old. So uh-huh. you're really tapping into that.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. It's like, okay, sorry. That is too long ago. I understand.
I really don't remember that well, how we communicated, but the terrible thing is he ended up being premature by 6 weeks. And that was where up until that point, it didn't matter. You know, like I had a book, All You Needed to Know About Being Pregnant or something like that. So mm-hmm. I had educated myself in English what to expect. I knew, you know, we could see what the different measurements are, like the heartbeats and the, I don't even know what else. But when he was premature, that was difficult because then he had to go into the hospital. You know, there's all kinds, he was underweight, so we had to go into an incubator. Mm-hmm. I wanted to feed him, but at that time, if he was in an incubator, he was not allowed to be breastfed. I didn't hold him until he was like 2 weeks old.
Yeah.
So there were all kinds of differences in that respect that,
yeah.
Again, in hindsight, you know, I don't know if we had known, maybe we wouldn't have done it, but
how can you know?
But you can't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, all right. But then moving forward a little bit, when your husband decided to move you guys back to the United States, was it immediately that you wanted to move back to Japan? Or did that just come up later?
No, it was... So all we knew was that he would go back and get his PhD. Mm-hmm. And after that, we didn't really know what to expect. Again, we expected that because he got his degree in linguistics. So we expected that it would be something to do with, you know, teaching English as a second language. And then just, you know, another opportunity came up almost as soon as he graduated. So it's like, okay, let's go back to Japan.
All right. So, okay. So it was not like, hey, we have to move back to Japan. Let's try everything in our power to go there. It was just by chance.
Well, I don't know if by chance. I mean, you know, he had developed some connections and we therefore had some connections. So it was a more natural progression than I think it's just chance. But, you know, both of us are in general pretty open-minded about and pretty good about opening doors and maybe just walking through doors that are open for us. So that was... he had a chance to teach at a really great university in Japan, and it was a 4-year contract. And we're like, okay, let's just try it again for another 4 years. And like almost every person, if you talk to any person, and I had listened to your podcast with another person who lived on the southern island in Japan, and I'm pretty sure he said the same thing. You come for a year or two and you stay for 20.
Yeah. He said that. That's right. Yes. Did you fall in love with Japanese culture, or why was it so easy to just stay there for so long?
That's a really good question. Fall in love. Fall in love is not how I would put it. If I were to say fall in love, I would say that I fell in love with Europe.
Okay.
Because a lot of times when you think about falling in love, it's you know, kind of immediate. It's almost a little bit superficial. It's not fully informed.
Yeah.
You know, you have some experiences and they're all really pleasant. But the thing about with Japan was... We liked it from the get-go. We were so enamored by the differences between, you know, our culture and the Japanese culture. But then we were just in it for so long. And so it's almost like a long-term relationship, you know, like you meet somebody. I mean, this is how I met my husband. When I think about it, it's the same thing. Like, I didn't fall in love with my husband. We met, we were friends, and then it just kind of slowly developed and we're like, hey, we love each other. Let's get married. And now we're 30 years into it. And I kind of feel that Japan was the same way. You know, like we liked it, we were interested, there were interesting things. And then the longer we were there, the more acclimated we became to it and the more... intimate we became with the culture and knowledgeable of it, so that it kind of seeped into us a little bit.
Okay. And were you then also an English teacher at that time when you came back, or?
Well, that was a big change for me, because when we went back the second time after my husband had his PhD and he went and taught at a university, at that time, then we had two small children, and I had been, while in the United States, I had my career. I was in marketing and PR and writing, and I had done that for a museum, which I absolutely adored.
Oh yeah, it sounds very interesting.
Done it for county government, and I just loved that job so much. And then we went to Japan, so I lost my job. You know, I had, and then I just became a full-time mother. And then I did have an opportunity to teach kindergarten children. But, you know, like, to be honest, that was a really depressing, like clinically depressing thing for me. Because I had gone from being in charge of this career to singing, you know, like the hello song. 25 times a day. And I would wake up at night, and then I would go home after teaching kindergarten children to my own small children.
Right.
So it was just that part. But once I quit that and started just kind of acknowledging, you know, being a mother and just a mother and doing the things that you know, when the kids started to go to school, I had a little bit of free time to do my own things as well. And, you know, once that happened, then I found a balance. And that was when I was able to start making my own friends and start being involved in the community and, you know, start having activities and things that I found satisfying in a different way than just motherhood.
That makes sense to me. Yeah. How did you then end up making friends? Do you remember that in the beginning?
That's also a really interesting question because at first we were in Osaka, which was a big city. And Osaka and Tokyo are known for being almost polar opposites, where people in Osaka are like really outgoing and friendly and talkative, and people in Tokyo, not so much. When my daughter started going to kindergarten, you know, I was able to meet some other mothers there.
Sure.
And by that time, I had a little bit of Japanese under my belt. And so I went and I took some flower arranging classes, which is called Ikebana, like the Japanese flower arranging. So by just becoming part of the community, by just kind of, even if it was only minimal communication. It was some communication.
That's fine.
And that was part of it.
Were your friends then mostly Japanese, or did you also find friends who were from other countries around the world?
In Osaka, it was purely Japanese. And then when we moved to Hadano, closer to Tokyo, there were a lot more foreigners around. And I ended up having a huge community of both Japanese and foreign friends.
Because you said in the beginning there were not a lot of English speakers when you first came, but then that was already 7-8 years later. So did that change then as well a little bit?
Well, the first time, you know,
you were also isolated.
We were some of the first foreigners to even go to that town. When we lived there, there were 1, 2, 3 other foreigners with us. Like, they taught at different schools. And I don't think we were the first group, but we might have been the second group who had been there. So really, it was just such a, we were like exotic animals.
You were famous, right?
We were. Oh my God, we were. Everybody knew who, and sometimes, like, I remember seeing this one man, I was walking on the sidewalk, and I don't know why, I happened to just look over, and there was this man, like, as he was driving by, I'm like, "Look at the road." We had never seen a foreign person before.
Oh, that is crazy. But, you know, I also had another episode about an English teacher. He was a teacher in Japan for a while as well. And he said, like, he got really sick of it. Or he was, like, not sick, but tired of it. Because everybody knew him, and like, he go into the store and says, like, "Oh, there is Teacher Eric. Hi, Teacher Eric." Everybody knew him by his name.
That is so true. I had people ask me for my autograph.
Oh, really? They thought you were like a rock star.
Exactly. Like, and coming, it's kind of interesting because I grew up in this really small town, and I always had this desire to leave. And I never really understood why, but, you know, as an adult now, I think that it's because as a small town, everybody knew you, everybody knew, you know, what you were doing. Like, I would be downtown, and by the time I got to my home, my mother would already know what I had done with my friends because, you know, so many people had called her. Osagi was a little bit like that. And yet it was really fascinating because we were foreigners, and maybe because we had, you know, I was 30 at that time, I guess, 30 something, you know, so that, you know, being a teenager or a young woman and being a approaching middle aged woman, you know, offered a completely different perspective about that.
Yeah, 100% for sure. But I also grew up in a very small town, and I always refer to this as well. Like, I'm like don't want anybody to know everything what I'm doing. But I never thought about it that this could have anything to do for me moving away.
Right, right. And yet probably it really did. And you just hadn't really realized
it. I mean, I always said, like, I'm going to move away to a bigger city where not everybody knows me. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I didn't have in mind back then when I was 15 to just move far, far away.
Right, right.
Yeah. So in the beginning, when you moved there, you probably like missed some things. But did you notice then the later you were there that you did not miss things anymore?
Oh, sure.
Like products or things?
No. I mean, again, because I had lived abroad for most of my adult life.
Ah, okay.
I didn't have the same cultural draw to my home that my mm-hmm. husband did.
Okay.
The only thing that I really, really missed was shoes.
Shoes?
because I'm 5'10" and I have size 10, size 11 feet. And in Japan, you can't get shoes if you're a woman over the size of 8.
Sure. Yes, and how? What did you do then? I mean, because that was before the internet.
Yeah. We would come back because of the kids. We would come back every year to visit the grandparents. Mm-hmm. And so I would come home with new shoes and so clothes.
Stuck up on shoes for the whole year.
Yeah. It sounds crazy, but I would. Sometimes I would just buy like 2 or 3 pairs of the same shoes, just know, because you walk everywhere in Japan.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, like I had, at first I went for the fashion shoes, like the shoes that I just loved. And then I realized, oh my God, I can't walk in these.
Yeah, then you have a real problem.
Right. So I had this like whole rack of beautiful shoes that I could never use, and then I would just bring, you know, 2 or 3 pairs of really good walking shoes every time.
Okay, well, you learned.
yes.
And how about learning the language? So how was your approach learning the language and getting by?
We even though we were there for 26 years, we never actually expected to be there that long. Uh-huh. So we never took lessons.
Oh, okay.
When we were in Hagi the first time, mm-hmm. There were like some community lessons for the foreign teachers. So we did mm-hmm. Take some of those. But literally, Japan has studied language and spoken language. Mm-hmm. And they are so different. So we were learning like the emperor's language.
Oh. Okay.
And then we would go out and try to use it, and people would be like, what?
So you talk like a.
So we would never hear the things that we were studying. And so, really, the best way, we just learned it by listening, which therefore took a lot longer than if we had mm-hmm. sat down and studied it.
Yeah.
And then also, because we were in the English-speaking world, you know, everybody right. who speaks to us wants to speak English. Uh-huh. They see it as a chance to, like, practice sure. their English. So it became a real issue at some point. Like, eventually we just found friends who don't speak English.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But then you're so limited the kinds of things that you can do together.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So and do you remember how long it took you to feel more comfortable speaking Japanese?
Well, I would actually say I'm still not 100% comfortable.
Okay.
It depends. Like, eventually I learned yoga, and I started teaching yoga to people. And so at that time, I was encountering people who just didn't speak any English whatsoever. Uh-huh. And so at that time, I really noticed a huge difference in, you know, what I could, how I could speak to people and what I could say.
Uh-huh.
And the funny thing is, you know, like I would have these Really? Like, I could tell you the names of bones in Japanese.
Okay, yeah.
My husband and I were out at a restaurant and they used a different way for asking us if we wanted cold water. And we're like, huh?
Okay.
So, you know, like it really depended on, like there would be times when I could speak fluently with somebody and then the topic would change. And if I didn't have that vocabulary, I wouldn't know anything. And okay. Like the cold water example, you know, people, we could ask for cold water, but somebody used a different word that we had not heard before at the restaurant.
And you were lost. And
some of us were like, what'd she say? I don't know. What'd she say? I don't know. Huh?
Yeah. Makes sense. And what about your kids?
Oh, they are 100% fluent. We made certain to put them in Japanese public school.
Uh-huh.
Because the first time when we went to Osaka, they were just little and we wanted them to have friends in the community.
Uh-huh.
So we put them in the school and within a year, you know, they were both like speaking pretty easily. And then mm-hmm. within 2 or 3 years, they were fluent. And okay. At one point, we had the neighbors across the street from us. They didn't speak any English.
Okay.
And they were over at our house. And we were sitting at a table, four of us. We were facing into the living room where my husband and I could see the children. But the people who were over, their children were with us. But their backs were to them. And one of the mothers said, if it weren't for the fact that I knew my son's voice, I wouldn't be able to tell who was the foreign child and who was the native child.
Okay.
So, you know, they picked it up at that age, just like that.
So quick.
And yes. The funny story is, it's a little bit embarrassing. When we went there the second time, you know, because my husband and I had been there, so we knew a little bit of Japanese. And so we would be able to speak a little bit of Japanese. And my kids were like, oh, whoa, mom and dad, you can speak Japanese. You're so cool. And then after like 1 year, they were like, mom, don't say anything.
You were so embarrassing. Why? You're saying it all wrong.
Exactly. Mom, stop, stop, stop.
Oh, God.
I feel like that.
Yeah. But did your kids speak to you in Japanese sometimes too? And you just...
No.
No?
No. It was all English at our house because my husband and I are both English speakers. And so they would speak to each other when they didn't want us to know what was going on. Or sometimes maybe just because that was the natural language speaking with other children.
Yeah. Oh, now I'm just asking because my son, he only talks English to us because my husband is also German and we only talk German in the house. And my daughter, the older one, she speaks to us in German.
Mm-hmm.
But the younger one, he doesn't talk any German. I mean, he understands. He understands everything, but he just responds in English.
That's really interesting because I've heard about that from people who are in mixed marriages where you'll have like an English speaker and a Japanese speaker together.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they'll hear both languages at home and then the children will choose which one is more comfortable for them.
Yeah.
But I haven't heard it in that situation where you're both German speakers and you speak German at home.
Yeah, I think he goes to daycare, so this is in English.
Mm.
And well, many times when he talks to me in English, then I answer him in English. It's just because I'm just so used to it that if somebody talks to me in English, I don't answer in German, you know?
Yeah.
But then I always like have to catch myself and then talk to him in German. But I don't know. Like every summer when we visit our family, then his German comes back more.
Uh-huh.
But once we are back here, he'll lose it. But he is so little. Who knows what it will be when he will grow a little bit more.
Well, one of the things that we did notice, my son lived in the United States for those 4 years.
Yeah.
And so his English was used, you know, outside of the house as well. My daughter, she was 2.5 when we moved back. Mm-hmm. And so all of her life, basically, she was in Japan. Mm-hmm. She understood, like your son, she understood English perfectly, but she did have more difficulty reading and expressing herself mm-hmm. than my son ever did.
And okay.
When it came to high school, the high school system in Japan is very competitive, and we had a little bit of a difficulty with that. So we ended up homeschooling her for her high school years.
Mm, okay.
And that just made all the difference, because she really struggled at first because her reading ability was not so good. Her, like I said, her ability to express herself. She mm-hmm. had complicated things that she wanted to say, but she didn't yeah. really know how to get it through in English. And then mm-hmm. by doing this homeschooling, it took her 5 years instead of 4, which okay. was what the curriculum was. But that's yeah. because the first year really was her kind of getting up to her academic skills that other kids who spoke English took for granted. So right. now that you mentioned that, I'd kind of forgotten about that, but I actually see a parallel between, you know, my daughter and her ability to express herself in English, and you know, maybe your mm-hmm. son and his German.
Yeah, well, we'll see how it will continue.
Well, one thing that we did was we did let them watch TV, because we figured that would give them. Like I grew up not really watching TV. My husband mm-hmm. grew up not watching TV, and I feel like that's why we love to read so much. But television was an area where they could, you know, be exposed to English in situations right. that were outside of like the household conversation.
So sure, and then maybe learn some other vocabularies that you mm-hmm. usually don't use.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. And you said that earlier, just to change topics a little bit again, and then you visited home like once a year, like home back to the United States.
Yes, because the grandparents wanted, you know, to see their
yeah kids. Yeah. Did they come visit you as well sometimes?
My mother-in-law lived there for a short time. She was also a teacher.
Okay.
My mother visited twice, I think.
Okay, yeah. Twice. Mm-hmm. And even though you were there for such a long time, was there anything that was hard for you to get used to?
No, not there. To be honest, coming back to
the United States, yeah.
That's a harder transition for me.
That's a harder transition. Okay, and why do you think is that?
You know, I had lived in a bunch of different places before. And, you know, I've lived in Australia, South Africa, and then a couple of different places in Europe. Mm-hmm. And so I like going someplace where I don't know, learning the place, learning, meeting people, learning the language. You know, so you get like kind of into this routine, I guess, about this yeah. is what you do when you go to a new place. But when I came back to the United States, you know, there are expectations of me here. I don't have a sense of community. And yet, you know, when mm-hmm. you're in your home country and with your home language, there's that expectation that you're going to have a community.
Do you know right. what I mean? Isn't it different though? Because, I mean, you for yourself know at least that you just came back. That, of mm-hmm. course, you don't have like a big friendship circle because you were away for such a long time.
Yeah. I wish, Victoria, that I had a clearer answer. I think a big part of it is that here in the United States, for example, you know, I don't have small children, so I don't have mm-hmm. a school or a mother network.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
To enter into. And I also don't have work. My husband, mm-hmm. he has a job and he loves his job, and he's not necessarily as much of a social person as I am, but he gets social interactions just by being at work, and he loves the people who he works with.
Mm-hmm. So it's a lot easier for him. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is. And I actually, I guess I was a bit naive. I thought, oh, I had these great jobs 24 years ago.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And get a job. And no, like I, not only did I not get a job, I actually only, like a lot of people, I didn't even get answers to my submitted resume. And so I don't have that community that the friends that I do have all came from my previous jobs when I was. And, you know, so I've kind of reactivated those friendships, but at some point I'm starting to figure it out, and I'll start getting into a community and, you know, going just like with the Ikebana that I did in Japan.
Yeah.
You know, like, okay, I'm going to go and try this. And that then got me into a community, and I could expand on that. But I don't know, coming back to a place that you're familiar with, it's just different than going to a new place. It's different in so many ways, in your expectations and the expectations that other people have for you. And I don't necessarily want to get into something and then be stuck there, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm still just trying to figure out where I am, where I fit in this.
Okay. And so what was behind the decision then to move back to the United States?
Elderly parents.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. This was not even like a decision where you said like, oh, maybe we can wait a little bit longer. Right. Yeah. So, was it just a natural decision? Was it like, oh yeah, we have to go home? Or was it like, maybe we can not go home and find a different way, like figure a way around
it? That was our attitude for the last couple of years.
Okay. Yes.
And then we always knew at some point we were going to have to actually make that decision.
Yeah.
And, a couple years ago, you know, like it's just, when my father passed away, then my mother was by herself. My husband's mother has been by herself for a long time. And, you know, as they get older, it just became more and more of our life there was taken up trying to deal with things that were happening here from halfway around the world.
Yeah.
Like my husband, you know, would wake up every day to messages about, okay, this has to be done. And he would be trying on the phone, you know, and the time difference is like exactly the opposite. So we would have this window, you know, like he would wake up and he would have like 1 hour to try to do something to solve some problem here. And it was just, at some point it was just like, you know what, this is just all consuming. And so that was when we decided we just have to make the decision and come home.
Okay. And okay, so, and besides like you having like trouble finding a community, how else has it been?
Culturally, there are some things that are both really good and really bad. I mentioned earlier that, you know, in Japan, we just walked everywhere. We didn't have a car in Japan. We had public transportation. Yeah. We walked. I had a bicycle, you know, like everything was just up to us to do something. Mm-hmm. And so if we were on the train, you know, we'd go into Tokyo, I'd be able to get work done if I was doing work. I'd be able to read. We would arrive just, you know, oh, here we are after this.
Yeah.
Tokyo. And here it's like the exact opposite. So much time is spent in the car. Mm. And driving is, I don't know what it's like wherever you are, but here driving is, it's like playing some kind of game where you don't know if you're going to make it or not. Like, I see people do the craziest things.
Oh, yes. And, yes. On the freeway, especially.
Yeah. On the freeways, but even on these like small, not like the little two-lane roads, but I have had people pass me like on the right, like on the shoulder.
Oh.
When they were, anyway, it doesn't matter. I could go into details.
It's too much road rage.
Road rage, yeah.
And for you, you haven't driven in all this time.
No, when we came back to the state, we always kept our driver's license.
Okay. It was not like, I haven't used a car in 20 years. Okay.
No.
Okay.
That would be even more terrifying.
Yeah.
No, we would always drive when we came back.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But still, just the amount of time that you spend in the car. And then that time is not relaxing time. It's very stressful. So that's a huge difference. Tipping.
No.
I still don't know what to do about tipping. It's like every time I'm like, what do I do? And I mean, I'm American. I know. I was a waitress.
But I think it also changed a lot since the pandemic because, I mean, I'm always like fine with tipping, but like now they expect you even to tip sometimes just to pay entrance or something because there is a person who's a cashier to whatever. And I'm like, it's just like the entrance fee. Why do I have to tip for this, you know? So sometimes it's just they asking at weird places to be tipped. If it's a waitress, anything to do with food service, I get it 100%. But
yeah.
Now it's everywhere.
I couldn't agree more. It's become overwhelming. You know, like a dollar here, a dollar there. You know, do you want to just round up? You know, like everybody is there's this drain, this constant drain of just money being randomly given to people. And, you know, even in restaurants at this point, like if I sit down and somebody is physically taking care of me, okay, that makes sense. But I was at a restaurant the other day. I ordered takeout. I came in. I ordered in front of the person. I waited for it. I took it. And they asked for it. They wanted a tip. I mean, they didn't ask for it. It was on the little pin.
It was on that, yes.
But
and now... Yeah, and now it's also...
Go ahead.
Sorry. And now it's also what I sometimes just find a little bit... I don't even know what the word is, but like I think it's a little bit too much if they already ask for 30% or even more.
Yeah.
You know, because like I remember if it's like... If they say like 10%, 15%, 20%, fine.
Right.
But like sometimes it just starts at 25% and I'm like, that's like not what I did or what I was used to.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And they do it for you, right? Like it's right there. It's like, oh, 25% is this much, 30% is this much. And I'm like, okay, well, luckily I can do math.
So yeah.
I'm only going to give you 15% or I mean, I usually give 20% if I'm at a restaurant. But no, absolutely right. It's become weird how much of a drain these things are. Like, I mean, even in a store that, you know, is like just a random retail store, they'll ask you, do you want to donate to, you know, like babies with cancer? I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah. Yes, because you feel bad if you don't do it.
Right.
Yeah, we had it yesterday. I had to, my daughter's birthday party was yesterday. So we ordered pizza from the closest chain that was by the playground. It was a Domino's. Mm-hmm. And when I ordered, it was also, do you want a roundup for St. Jude's? And I'm like, well, I cannot say no to St. Jude's, of course. I have to round up.
Right, exactly. They know how to get us. And and I have to say, Victoria, I've had a little bit of an issue of tipping where I had a job and I could see where the tip was, like where somebody had given a tip, but I did not receive the tip.
Yeah.
And now I have to wonder, like with some of these places, like I believe restaurants and whatnot give their staff tips, but if I'm at a grocery store and they ask, do you want to give, you know, a certain amount to this charity? Like, I don't know anymore. Like, is that, like, does all of that money go to the charity or is it just some percentage? Like, right, now I'm okay. starting to question because it's so frequent. And because the things that they say are like really tearing at your heartstrings, like, I'm like, is this bona fide?
I think that's what I'm thinking. If it's like a big chain, I think they cannot just lie about it. Because, I mean, they would just ruin their reputation.
Yeah. I don't know. I want to look into it, but I haven't.
Yeah. Anything else besides tipping that it's hard for you to get used to now?
I don't know if... I don't want to only say the bad things. So I want to say one of the other good things about the United States is... Every time I've come here, and I noticed it way back in the 80s when I first came back from Australia, and that is just the diversity of people. Mm-hmm. You know, when you come, just as soon as you get off the airplane, you come into the airport, there's just diversity of people and languages and clothing styles and coming, like in Australia, you know, I noticed it at first because when I would come into LA, it was like, oh, wow, right, I'd forgotten.
Yeah. Yes.
And then in Japan, you know, it's another, you know, pretty homogenous society.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, coming from those two places into America, I think coming from Europe, it's not so much because Europe now is so diverse as well. But whenever I came back from Japan, I would notice it, and I would love hearing, you know, just all the languages and seeing this diversity of people. And I never get tired of that. When I actually volunteered for a political organization, and I was in charge of the database when I was in Japan. And, you know, you go through a list of people in the United States and literally, and I mean like that word literally.
Yeah.
There are people and there are names from every part, every country and every ethnicity in our country. And that is really, like, for me, that is a really positive thing. I think that's what makes our country strong. I think that's what makes our country special. And I celebrate that whenever I would come back.
That's nice.
And even now, you know, like just, you know, walking around, even in my little town where, I mean, I'm in Delaware. Delaware is hardly, you know, like the magnet for immigrants. And yet, even so, I see so many people of, you know, different backgrounds. It's really nice.
But I can say something to that because, like, we used to live in the Bay Area and in San Francisco and Oakland. And I always said that also. It's like, I enjoy that there is such a big multicultural scene here that people are from everywhere. And then we moved to Austin, Texas. And then I was like, there are only white people here.
Wow.
You know, but I mean, it's not really true. There's a big Hispanic community here. Mm-hmm. But it was just in the neighborhood that we lived in. I didn't feel anything. And also, it was in the middle of the pandemic. It was just like white and blonde people. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I miss it. Yeah. And then I was actually very happy that my daughter went to the ESL program in school, because then she was also in a class with kids from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was really nice.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear because, you know, I know that Austin is a liberal city and so I would not have expected that it was also still, you know, diverse.
Yeah, you have also a more diverse. It was probably because of that neighborhood that we were in.
Yeah. Yeah.
And because of pandemic. But I mean, for sure, you have such a big Hispanic population here and Black population as well. And I feel like where we are now, I don't feel it as much, but there are a lot of Asians here as well. Not couldn't say that though. I couldn't confirm that.
Well, that's I guess where I live, it's a little bit of a college town. I don't live right in the college town, but I guess close enough that, you know, just going shopping, just going to the library, just even just walking around, you know, I see a lot of Muslims. I see a lot of people wearing the hijab, I guess it's called. And when I hear Spanish everywhere, which is so good because I'm trying to study Spanish. So I can just hear it, you know, like just around me. It's like, oh, I understood that word. Oh, I understood that sentence. You know, and that's one of the things to learn a language. You have to be able to hear it spoken.
Yeah, I always think it's a shame that not every school teaches Spanish at the same time. No, and I think, I mean, here it is only if a certain percentage of the, whatever, the families in that circle of the school are Spanish speakers, then they offer it. But for our little school, there is nothing. The next school is.
Yeah, well, you get to hear it in the community too, and you'll have, I mean, you can have you can have a way of learning it, I guess, without having to take it in the classroom.
Is there anything from Japan that you miss?
The oddest thing is I miss ramen.
Okay. Is the one you had here not good?
You know,
or not comparable.
It's good enough, but it's, you know, ramen is just everywhere in Japan. And you just, I feel like I'm a little bit late to the party, so to speak. You know, like I love ramen, but I went for a long time without any, you know, specialty ramens. We would just eat ramen if it just happened to be, you know, something around and we were hungry.
But,
you know, I guess in the last 5-6 years, we started seeking out ramen from different places. And it really, it's really good. And I miss it. And of course, you know, like you can't live somewhere for 26. Well, in this case, we lived in that little town for about 15 years.
But that's a long time.
Yeah, and you know, so I miss my friends. I miss my free time as well. Here, I mean, I know it sounds crazy because I was just saying about how I don't have a job or anything, and yet somehow I'm always busy. Part of it is because so much time is spent traveling in a car.
Okay. Yeah.
But you know, I miss my friends. I miss the community. Like we had by the time I left, like I had this community around me, and we did events together. And like the 2 months before I left, we had gotten together, and there were these big walls along the river where that ran through our town. And so we got permission from the city to paint pictures on that wall. You know, of birds and plants and like Mount Fuji, for example, because we could see Mount Fuji from the town where we were. And you know, there were like about, I don't know, 30 or 40 of us who worked on that project. Those kinds of things, I miss. And I just, this is the last thing I'll tell you about this. I miss the kindness in a way. And I don't mean to say that Americans aren't kind, because of course they are, but I guess it goes along with the driving that I was saying. Like, I feel all the time that Americans are a little bit on edge. You know, like people aren't always kind to you. And, you know, like I see people, like if somebody takes too long at the light, and I'm not talking about me, because I don't take too long at the light. But if somebody does, you know, like the person behind, beep, 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 beep. It's like, whoa, just hold on. They're on their way. Or, you know, people I feel like the t-shirts. I see these t-shirts that have really offensive things on them that are kind of like designed specifically it seems to like trigger someone.
Yeah, okay.
And those kind of things, I'm like, that's, no, I don't feel comfortable with that. I feel a little bit like, what, why? What's the purpose to that?
I mean, I always think Americans are very friendly, but you are right. Like, I think maybe inside of them, they're like very on edge, as you said. Okay, so I have another question, kind of. So since you just moved back, and I know the having vacation in the US is like so, or you don't have a lot of paid days. Do you go back to Japan then if you have like the time, or do you want to go somewhere else?
Yeah, my son is there.
Okay. Your son is there.
Uh-huh. My son and his wife are in Tokyo. We were going to go back this summer, and we looked at the prices, and we just can't afford it.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know how much that is from, you know, like the airline industry still recovering from the pandemic. So, you know, perhaps in another year or so that will be different. But I do want to go back. Of course to see my son, but also like I just want to see Japan again, you know, like, I mean, it was our home. We had two homes. When I was in Japan, I would talk about, you know, home in America.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I'm in America, I talk about home in Japan. And, you know, you can't live somewhere for that long without it becoming part of you. And so then when you tear away from that, you know, it's almost, I guess, like losing a limb. Like you still feel it in some way.
Mm-hmm.
It still draws your attention in some way.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I would live, when I would live somewhere for so long and then go back a short time after, like how I would feel just visiting it and knowing don't stay here anymore, or I don't live here anymore.
That's exactly right. Because as I said, we came here regularly as a visitor to see family, to see friends. Mm. But when you have that limited time, you know, you're crazy busy. You're always going to see somebody else.
Yeah.
You're going to do something. Like the time flies by, you have a full plate, and then you go back to your life. And, you know, and in this case, it's not limited. And I think that's partly what makes it it makes it a little different to adjust to, because you're not a visitor. You have to find a life again.
Yeah.
And it entails, I mean, it took us, you know, 24 years to find a life in Japan. And like you can't, and I think that partly that's on me, you know, thinking, well, I've been here for a year. Where's my community? What's my purpose for being here? You know, like I'm putting that pressure on me. But I mean, when you think about it, most people don't have to do that. And you don't have the culture shock, the reverse culture shock as well to deal with. So, you know, that takes time. But it also evolves, you know, it's not just like, oh, okay, this is going to be what I do now.
No, I know. It takes time for sure. I mean, that's also like a reason why I do the podcast, because I was also like, I just cannot be just a stay-at-home mom and only do that and wonder what else could I do but not do. So I'm like, okay, I'm just going to do the podcast, and at least I have like creative outcome or like a purpose,
right?
Kinda,
that's so, you know, true. Yeah, that is, and it's little things like that. Like when you started that podcast, you didn't even know probably the role that it would play. It would be just like, I think I'll do a podcast to see,
exactly,
like, explore that. And now it's like probably really part of you,
exactly, and it feels like work, you know? So it feels like, hey, I really have to do this. Like, I have a timeline.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no pressure, only if it comes from me. I don't have a boss or anything. But like still, like for me, this is important. This is work. So, and I enjoy it. So my days or my weeks feel a lot better. Or like, yeah, so it's good for myself. Yeah.
And it's good to hear the experiences from people who are in the same situation as you. You both hear the similarities that they have, that you have, but also the differences, and you hear how, you know, they coped with it. And that's really therapeutic in a way, even if you don't need it to be therapeutic.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, I remember like I was venting to like the other mothers, you know, who are all like Americans, and they, I don't think they could understand me, because I was like, I want to work, but I cannot work because at this moment I don't have a work authorization, you know, I'm waiting for it. And they're like, okay. So, you know, they could not really understand where I was coming from.
Right.
But so this is nice that other people are in a similar boat. Yeah. Of course, this is therapeutic. Yeah. And okay, but before we leave, I also wanted to talk about your podcast.
Oh, my wonder. I love my podcast so much. I love my podcast.
So what is it called and what is it about?
It's called The Kaidan Kai, and it is where I read ghost stories and supernatural stories out loud. And it's a little different. Like if you look at a lot of the ghost story podcasts, most of them are classic ghost stories, stories that are in the public domain. But mine are from modern writers, you know, from all over the world. I get them from India, from Australia. I just recently did one from Romania, I think it is. And I love it. And it, I started it during the pandemic just for something to do. And then it was based on the idea of kind of the equivalent of the Japanese version of campfire stories.
Nice.
So the idea is like if you've ever been to a campfire, you know, like all these people will tell stories, and each story is a little different. It's different themes, different story styles, different, you know, sometimes they're goofy, sometimes they're really scary. And that's the idea behind this as well. You know, like when you ghost stories are like they can be told in any genre. And the Kaidan Kai, I'm pretty sure, has most of those genres. Some story.
Are they fiction, or is it just people's experiences?
No.
Or is it both?
It's all fiction. It's
okay.
Yeah, because there are a lot of true story paranormal podcasts. And I just want fiction stories.
Okay. All right. Okay. So everyone has to check it out. I will put the link on this in the show notes.
Oh, yeah.
And when I publish this podcast episode, I will also put a link on it on Instagram.
Thank you. That's great. That would
be great. For sure. Yeah. Okay. I think we're getting to an end of this episode. Thank you very much for taking your time. No, sorry. I said this wrong. Thank you very much for taking time to be on here.
Oh, it was my pleasure. I'm so happy to talk with you about that. You know, I listen to your podcast. Not every single week, I'm afraid, but I have listened to several of them. And that's why I said how interesting it is to know other people who have, you know, been in these same situations and hear their experiences. So thank you for doing it. It's really a nice podcast that's very helpful, I think.
Thank you. Yes, that was Linda's story, and she already gave such a nice ending to the podcast, so I feel I don't need to add anything more except of to check out her podcast, The Kaidan Kai. And you will find the info in the show notes, or just search for it wherever you listen to podcasts. And then something that I always mention. So if you would like to be a guest on this podcast, then why don't you reach out to me at worldscollide123pod@gmail.com and send me a quick message. Or you can also do the same at Instagram or Threads or TikTok. I would be happy to have you on the show. I'm always looking for guests. Okay, until then, I hope you tune in again next week. Until then, bye. Oh, and don't forget to tell everyone about this podcast if you like it. Bye.